Well, I actually don't work on plumes, so it was an interesting idea to talk about mineral physics in plumes. We've been working on the core for the last several years, so it's kind of fun to go back and look at some of this stuff. And this is basically the mineral physicist mecca. One always compares your laboratory data to the PREM model. I've always been waiting for the real reference Earth model. I guess someday it'll come out. It's been around for a while. Actually, it was in reference to this diagram. It was kind of fun when I was a grad student. Thorne and I think were at a conference together in France, and we went and visited Lairs, which in the Pyrenees is the type section of Lairsolite. And I was standing next to Don Anderson, and I picked up a rock, and I said, "Oh, 3.3," and Don said, "Oh no, 8.0." And I looked at him very strangely, and he goes, "Kilometers per second." So you could tell we had different coordinate systems, and so meetings like this are good to be able to actually see if you can translate between these coordinate systems. So anyhow, the back when 20 years ago, the world was really a simple place. Raymond Johnlow and Frank Richter had basically convinced me, in combination with Don DiPaolo, that the mantle was layered. The upper mantle convected separately from 670 or 660 upward to the surface, and then the lower mantle convected. And then eventually Don collected more than two or three data points and decided that the lower mantle or the upper mantle barrier had to be leaky. So it was still relatively simple. You know, we extracted boards from the upper mantle region, and the plumes came from somewhere in the lower mantle, probably D double prime. Then in the early 90s, I guess, or middle 90s, images started to appear of slabs that actually penetrated through the 660 and all the way to the core mantle boundary. So suddenly we had to rethink these models. No longer were two-layer mantle convection a very simple and clean idea that fit most of the data. So now it looked like you know, the whole mantle convection was a reality, and that plumes could come from possibly even the slabs or some portion of the slabs. So eventually, thank you. Whoops. Went to there. We actually got tomographic images of the actual hotspots, some of which were imaged all the way down to the core mantle boundary, as in the case of these, if I didn't go too far, and then some that actually appeared to start at more shallow depths comparatively. So the mineral physics now, we need to start someplace, and there are several things we need to think about, and that's the location of the source of the plumes. Is the source region at 660 for some plumes? Is it D double prime for other plumes? And we need to know the phase diagram, as Dave Stevenson said yesterday. But even one step further back, we need to know which phase diagram, because we need to know what the composition of the source region is. And there are just a variety of things. It could be the basalt part of the crust, or a depleted Harzburgite that is just underlaying the actual basaltic crust, or quote-unquote normal mantle, or even what's in D double prime if it's something distinct. So what we do in mineral physics is to take our laboratory data, usually elasticity data collected near room temperature and room pressures, and going towards the deep Earth. No one's really collected in situ data of a complete set that we really want for very deep mantle phases and core phases. And extrapolate these to higher pressures and higher temperatures. So we need equations of state, and we also need some sort of composite theory. In other words, I tend to work on very simple systems because I can try and understand those better. Once you put more than two elements in a diamond cell, it becomes very messy, as far as I'm concerned. You need to take those minerals and then combine them, their properties, to get an aggregate that is isotropic on a large seismic link scale. And one question is which do you actually do first? Do you take each mineral and apply your equation of state to get to the high pressures and temperatures and then mix the minerals together at that point? Or do you mix the minerals, come up with an isotropic composition, and extrapolate that to high temperatures and pressures? And it's actually, there's some evidence, just at room temperature, that this doesn't work. And this comes out in some work we did on measuring the Brillouin P-wave velocity speeds in alkali halides as a function of pressure in composites, so polycrystalline material, and then comparing that to extrapolated single crystal elastic constants. And actually turns out that the two don't quite agree, and these experiments were equivalent to doing the equation and mixing, or mixing and the equation state. So this is something that is an interesting project that someone could actually sit down and take some of the existing data and try these different techniques. Let me just describe some of the data that we actually do. There's diamond cell data, where we do high temperature pressure volume studies. We also try to do Brillouin scattering in a diamond cell to get elastic constants, the single CIJs of crystals as a function of pressure, and we're working on temperature. And there's a whole variety of techniques. There's some polycrystalline aggregate experiments that Dave Mao pioneered that give us the CIJs as a function of pressure and temperature if you laser heat. There's large volume experiments where they've been measuring ultrasonics, which give both the bulk properties and the shear properties, which is one thing that's tough to get out of diamond cell data except for the Brillouin data. So there's a whole variety, and then shockwave techniques also. The problem with shockwaves is you don't really know the structure at high pressures. You know the pressure volume very carefully, but you don't know the structure of the materials. So the step we really need to take is to actually study real rocks in a diamond cell. And even though I don't like doing this, it's something we really need to do. And people have done this for a while. And there are good reasons to actually study the entire rock. And I'm just illustrate these with two examples from some of the work we've done on the core. And that's, if we just take pure iron, it has a phase diagram that people have measured, and the HCP phase is what is believed to be in the inner core, or has been believed. And it turns out when you add approximately 6 weight percent silicon at high pressures and temperatures, it stabilizes the BCC phase, which is the low pressure phase or structure of iron. So a minor element can actually affect the structure of the mineral itself. And then in a related study, an Epsilon FESI, both Quinton and Elise studied this at one point in time, and we also did. We get slightly different equation of state numbers, but we both agree that at the very highest pressures we attained, which were 70 to 80 GPa, heating FESI in the Epsilon crystal structure, it was stable. It never transformed to anything else. And a group, I forgot the reference, in England, actually looked at this same system but with an excess of iron in the sample, and the FESI, Epsilon FESI, transformed to the cesium chloride structure. So just by adding in iron, which possibly affects the oxidation state or something, again affects the crystal structure. So the point is you can't just take your real simple systems and combine them theoretically. You really need to put them next to each other and have all the minor and trace elements together to actually see what comes out. And so people have done this, and the problem is for plumes, for instance, is there some discrepant results. For instance, Kessin studied pyrolite and morb, and at 1,100 kilometers depth and at the core mantle boundary, and had Prem being lighter than pyrolite and pyrolite being lighter than morb for both cases. Hiros et al. Came up with Prem being less than morb, which is consistent with the above. And then Lars Stixreed has done some calculations where he has the Prem being lighter than morb, which is consistent with everyone, but the depleted Hartzberg aggregate is actually lighter than Prem. And so these things switch around somewhat, and it's not very good for us to be able to tell what would be convectionally unstable if it were heated up, or actually whether it could even be subducted to D double prime. So this has a bearing on what one would look at as a source material, whether it would be stable, because if you melt something that's, or heat something up, even though it's still dense, it may just stay stably at the bottom of the mantle. This is what the diamond cell looks like. I don't know if you've seen a picture of it in the last couple of weeks, but it's a pair of gem quality diamonds that are opposed anvils with a small face cut, and then there's a gasket with a hole drilled into it where the sample in pressure transmitting media and a pressure gauge is put. And here's schematically from the side, the upper diamond, the lower diamond, pressure chamber, the sample, and the gaskets on the side. The nice thing about diamond is you can see through it. So you can see your sample well, it's at high pressures. X-rays go through it and so do laser beams. So we use lasers to heat the sample to get it to high temperatures to mimic the interior of the Earth. And then we put this all onto a synchrotron light source. And this is what the system is going to look like at the advanced photon source. It should by this weekend, I believe, except for the CO2 part of the laser system. Vicky will be able to tell us. She's using it this weekend, she's using the one next to it. Anyhow, there are several lasers. The diamond anvil cell would sit approximately in here. The X-ray beam would be coming through here. There's some pre-optics and slits and such, and then the detector, an imaging plate in this case, sits there. The laser beams are brought in and heated the diamond cell from both sides to heat the sample up. So we measure the temperature through those optics and then collect the diffraction pattern simultaneously. And this is just the only diamond cell sample photo I have. This is actually looking at iron with hydrogen in it. This is a study that Wendy Mao and Dave and company have been working on. This is approximately 250 microns across. So you can see that one of the issues right now is just size of the sample. The laser beam itself tends to be about 30 to 50 microns across, depending on how well the laser couples to the sample itself. Things that don't couple very well only heat small hot spots. Things that couple really well, you tend to get a much larger hot spot. Some of the restrictions. Some of the work had been done on large volume presses, which are larger presses that take up more of a room than a diamond cell. A diamond cell you can fit in your pocket. It's just you don't want to walk through an X-ray detector with one. But the large anvil cells have samples that I sort of think of as the size of the head of a pin, whereas our samples in the diamond cell are more like the tip of the pin. They have the nice ability of actually being able to analyze their samples with an electron microprobe in a very straightforward way. The grain size is large enough that they can unambiguously do the chemical composition of things. The problem is when they find phases that might be important in the lower mantle, they don't have much of a handle on extrapolating to the deep mantle because they don't cover a very large pressure range in the lower mantle itself. Diamond anvil cells, on the other hand, the sample size is much smaller, but you can get to much higher pressures. But the problem with the sample size, it makes it very difficult to do the chemical analysis because the grain size is on the order of tens of nanometers in a lot of the silicate systems. I'm not sure exactly what size they are in the irons. So an electron microprobe averages over many, many grains. You don't get just the composition of a single grain. You need to go to a TEM to actually try and study these things. And it's incredibly difficult to do this. It's a little tiny sample that's 20, 30 microns across that you put on a grid and you want to ion thin. And I tried many years ago at the sample, the ion thinner at Berkeley has a lot of little perovskite samples sitting down below that have just been burned off of the grids. Also, the diamond cell, there's basically a limited access to the reciprocal space when you're doing X-rays. What I mean is people, when they first did X-ray diffraction, would just put a crystal on a little horsehair, for instance, and have the entire area to collect diffraction lines. With the diamond cell, because we have to support the diamonds, and the apertures at which you can see out of are limited, you can only see so many X-ray lines. And the problem with that is when you have very complex materials, materials like what Dan Shim was talking about, there are a lot of lines. And that's for a simple single component system. Let's call it a single component system. When you add in many components and have many phases, the diffraction patterns can be very, very difficult to interpret, particularly if they're solid solution effects. So this becomes a little bit of a problem, particularly in terms of the number of lines you see.
Can you try some image cloud technique like future extraction?
We do, but we're limited by the resolution of the detectors, which is part of the problem right now. So, but we do use fairly sophisticated programs for analyzing. This is an example of an experiment on a rock by Haros. Dave Mao was one of the co-authors on this. And you can see that it's a complex assemblage. There's majorite plus clinopyroxene plus stishovite. Over here you get into the calcium perovskite and an aluminum-rich phase. And over here there's an aluminum calcic phase. So you can see that it's quite complex. There's a lot of lines. So there could be possibly problems when doing some of these systems if there are minor phases there in the small volume of a diamond cell that you might not pick them up or see the X-ray lines. And so it's really important to actually go in and look at these things in terms of with a TEM and an SEM. And that's one of the exciting things that is coming in the future. First, there's the Large Diamond Anvil Cell Initiative, which Dave Mao is heading. Dave wants to make 5-carat diamonds, if not bigger, right? To actually scale up the size of the diamond anvil cell sample so that there's a much larger sample there. It's particularly important for using neutrons to study the sample. Another interesting thing that Harry Green is working on is the focused ion beam machining. Remember I talked about the samples that are at the bottom of Rudy Venk's ion thinner. The idea here is they have very fine machines now to actually machine small wafers. And you need a very thin sample for a TEM. And you can select the area that you want to look at with the TEM, machine out the little wafer, lift it out, and put it on a grid and study it directly with the TEM. And that's a very exciting possibility. When you put a sample on a grid now and ion thin it, you take where you get it. Where the edge ends up is where you study. With this, you actually have the chance of looking exactly where you want to go. And then finally, the bigger and higher resolution X-ray detectors are going to make looking for minor phases much better. And in fact, this also, combined with the TEM, makes it much easier to look for the final phases. And I think that's the last slide. Yeah, so this is one of the possible source areas. It's just a question of where the plumes actually come from and what they're coming from. And then, once we know some of that, we can do the phase diagrams, hopefully. Thanks.
How big will the samples be in the big how big will the samples be then?
It's the sampling thing. The scale up is on the sample of the inside of the diamond. Right now we typically use a quarter of a carat diamond. And if we can 25 carat diamond, then it will be 100 times bigger sample of what we normally use. So our goal is like 400 carat.
100 times wider or 100 times
larger? 100 times larger in volume.
Large.
So if you make it 1,000 times, it will be 10 times bigger than the other.
Do the diamonds become weaker as they get bigger? Is that a problem, or can you control them?
Yes, so you're talking about, so first we need to grow a single crystal diamond, the polycrystalline. CBD in the past only applies to polycrystalline. We can grow a single crystal, then probably should be similar to diamond, except it may have cleavage. But the CBD process we developed in a way, it has the imperfection, but the imperfection can stop the growth.
So how much does it cost to make a big diamond?
Why haven't everyone jumped in to do an experiment of the total cost that the reason is, you can get the pressure every time you make a pair of diamonds, and then it's $2,000 plus your time, so everyone has a limited budget, so the product spread is low. You have to be sure everything is well prepared. But if you can, the diamond is $10 a piece, then
So what do you do exactly?
What do you do with these diamonds after the experiment? It's a magic platinum and the gold. You can recycle the diamond to end up like powder. You can burn it.
I have a little drawer of diamond corpses at Chicago that are all together.
Diamond.